Hello and welcome to She's the Doctor, the podcast where we hear from women in medicine about their life and career so far. We'll discuss their interests and achievements, but also explore challenges and failures. I'm your host, Dr. Radhika Thakra, an oversharing houseplant-loving pediatric trainee in London. Every week, I'll be interviewing women from a range of backgrounds in a variety of medical specialties and at different points in their career, each with their own story to tell. Dr. Hannah Barham-Brown is a fascinating woman. With 3 degrees, English, pediatric nursing and medicine, Hannah is a GP registrar, wheelchair user, deputy leader of the Women's Equality Party, and a lot more. In today's episode, Hannah tells us about her diagnosis of Ehlers-Danlos syndrome during medical school, which required her to start using a wheelchair. She shares the challenges she faced starting as a junior doctor using a wheelchair, but also tells us how it enabled patients to relate to her as their doctor and communicate more openly. Hannah is passionate about diversity in the workplace, particularly for disabled people. She has 2 TEDx talks about diversity in the NHS, which I'd really recommend you listen to, and works to support disabled people in a variety of contexts, from wheelchair access to cervical cancer screening and everything in between. As deputy leader of the Women's Equality Party, she works towards making change happen, improving women's representation in society, reducing the gender pay gap, and campaigning for women's rights. Hannah was such a fun and interesting guest to record with, and I really learned a lot from her. She's completely changed my understanding of disability in the workplace, especially in a hospital setting, and has really highlighted the importance of representation and diversity in all parts of life. Welcome to She's the Doctor, Hannah. Thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you for having me. It's really exciting.
Thank you. So could you please tell us just a little bit about yourself? I know there's a lot to say, but I would love to just hear from you how you'd introduce yourself.
Oh, gosh. It often depends on the audience, I'll be honest. So I'm Hannah Barham-Brown. I'm a GP registrar. I live up in Yorkshire. I am also a wheelchair user, and I'm somebody that wears a lot of different hats because I work clinically about 60%, so effectively 3 days a week. But I'm also deputy leader of the Women's Equality Party. I'm a governor of Motability. I work with a number of different charities, and I spend a lot of time going around giving talks about diversity and equality, so particularly around disability and LGBTQI type stuff. I'm quite busy, but I enjoy everything I do. I'm really lucky.
Oh, that's so cool. I can't believe how many hats you have. Like, I don't think there's enough space in your Twitter bio to fit everything in.
It is genuinely quite a struggle.
Do you mind just taking it back to the beginning? Because I know you've had a bit of a convoluted route into medicine. Mm-hmm. And taking it back to telling us your story of how you got into medicine and where you went after school, I guess.
Yeah, so I'll try and keep it as abbreviated as possible because you're right, it was incredibly convoluted. So I went to run-of-the-mill comprehensive in Suffolk. I then decided that I really wanted to be a war correspondent. So I went to Durham and I read English and Theology with Arabic. Had a great time, didn't really do much actual academic work. And my mother made it quite clear that I was not going to be a war correspondent because, and I quote, I would get shot and end up in a wheelchair. I was at this point completely non-disabled. So the irony is not lost on me. I had that kind of thing of what the hell do you do with a BA in English type scenario. But around the end of my Durham degree, towards my finals, my baby brother Theo was born. He spent a lot of time in intensive care. He had quite significant Down syndrome and was significantly disabled. And I kind of saw how amazing the care that he was getting, but also the care my family were getting in the neonatal unit. And I kind of sat there going, oh, I could do that. That looks amazing. But I had no science A-levels and I still have no science A-levels. So I wanted to kind of be there to support Theo and my parents because my mum's also a wheelchair user with something completely different. So I ended up getting into paediatric nursing through clearing within about a month of graduation. My whole family had moved up to Newcastle by this point, so I kind of was able to live with them. In those days, you got a bursary and your tuition fees paid to do nursing, which was fantastic. And I could help be a carer for Theo. So did all of that. Loved nursing, but it just wasn't quite the right fit for me. And there was always this little voice in the back of my head going, why not try being a doctor? See what that looks like.
Yeah.
Ended up really fortunately getting into St. George's. It's the only place that would interview me, let alone the only place that accepted me. Got onto their postgrad course and had a fantastic time. Did a bit more work at George's than I did at any of my previous degrees. And it was all kind of going to plan. I was going to be a pediatric plastic burn surgeon. Was the career.
Wow. Because
I'd done some placements as a nurse and absolutely loved the work. But in my penultimate year, one of my other brothers, Gareth, who'd had a heart transplant 9 years previously, he developed sepsis and he sadly died. So I thought, right, I'm going to do that typical medic thing of going straight back to medical school within about 2 weeks of his death. And the way I decided to kind of process all of the grief I was experiencing was to try and run a half marathon. It was around that point that I discovered every time I ran, my right kneecap would disappear behind my leg and like fully dislocate. The joints started misbehaving as well. I'm incredibly stubborn and frankly incredibly stupid in that I carried on running, did the half marathon, but was not long after diagnosed with Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, which mm-hmm. I certainly wasn't taught about at med school. And so I kind of started medical school as quite a keen like runner and sporty type person and graduated in a wheelchair. And I'd had to like crowdfund my own wheelchair and all this sort of stuff. Now, alongside all of this, the junior doctor's contract dispute was going on in my final year. And I'd previously done a lot of comms and media work with various organisations I'd been linked with. So I got quite involved in that side of things, was on the picket line and all this sort of stuff. Ended up getting involved with the British Medical Association. So went full angry trade unionist. Really loved it. Got like properly involved. Ended up within about a year, I was deputy chair of the Junior Doctors Committee. And then from there, the BMA did a big report into women's health. And I ended up doing like Women's Hour and stuff talking about this. And this organization called the Women's Equality Party invited me to speak at their conference about women's health and unmet health needs. And my cat gets really excited by this part of the story and is now trying to join in with me.
I love that your cat's just jumped on the chair.
Simba just likes to join in. I went along to the conference. By the end of the conference, having sworn off party politics for life, I'd joined the Women's Equality Party. Within 6 months, I was a local council candidate and then an EU parliamentary candidate. And within about 18 months, I was deputy leader of the party and still am. So I've had a really weird route into medicine and I now have quite a bizarre portfolio career, but I love it. It's great.
I love that. That is amazing. Like, you have so many different hats on your head. I feel like you need more heads to fit the hats on. I love how you've just kind of found all of these different parts of your career and passions and interests, and you've made them part of your job, and you've done that so well, but also you've had such a journey there as well. There are so many things I want to talk about from what you've just said. So, you know, that 5 minute whistle stop tour of your life has a lot to unpack. First of all, thinking about your move from nursing to medical school, how did you find that? Did you feel like, yeah, this is the place I'm meant to be, given you'd already had two different kind of careers already?
I found it incredibly hard to start with, you know, not having, I mean, pediatric nursing was a really great degree in many ways, but it was a lot kind of on the practical, how to do the ward stuff, and then the communications, reflection, all of that sort of stuff. There was very little clinical science in it at all, if any. And so I found the transition, having not studied science properly for 8-9 years, possibly longer by that point, I basically, because as a grad entry, you have to squeeze the first 2 years into 1 year. So I was basically just cramming basic clinical sciences. I'd be in the library at 8 a.m. I'd leave 9, 10, 11 o'clock at night pretty much every day for the first year. And so that was really tough and it was a bit skin of my teeth. But then once I got into the clinical years, all of the experience I'd accrued as a nurse, because you're on placement from the very first like couple of weeks as a nurse, all that experience I'd had on wards in the community, working with patients, that kind of multidisciplinary team approach, that really came into its own. So where I wasn't so hot on the science, and I'd argue I'm still not the most, you know, scientific research academic type doctor, I think the other areas really made up for that. And I feel I'm very lucky that I went to a med school where that kind of variety in background, particularly for the grad entry, was so prized at George's. And it's something I'm really, really pleased I went there, because they were so good about supporting all of us, whatever crazy background we came from.
Yeah, I come across a lot of St. George's medical students, and it's so interesting hearing what the grads were doing in a previous life and how they've come to medicine, especially as someone who went straight through and I've like literally gone from school to med school to pediatric training. It's so nice to hear other stories and what other people have been up to and just understand the diversity of doctors a bit more as well.
Yeah, definitely. I think that diversity is really important, because actually our patients are quite a diverse bunch. So it makes sense that their doctors are as well.
Exactly. And then if you don't mind, could we talk a little bit more about your diagnosis and when you started to find that your body wasn't doing what you wanted it to and your knees were dislocating? Can you tell us a bit more about that?
So it was, I think in a weird and kind of awful way, it was a lot easier than it could have been, because I'd just been through quite a significant bereavement. So actually, when my body started misbehaving on me, it was just like, okay, that's another thing I'm just going to have to get through. And also, in a way, I'm incredibly privileged, because I grew up around disability. So my mum has a neurological condition, a form of spinocerebellar ataxia. And it's super, super rare, but from like birth, I was in and out of child development centres. I was constantly being assessed.
Okay.
And there was an expectation that I was going to end up developing what she had. So in a way, I'd already kind of done years of preparation for becoming disabled. I just weirdly became disabled in a completely different way to what I'd expected. So I think that did help, but it also meant the practical elements of it. You know, I knew basic things like how to get around in a wheelchair. I knew how to get a wheelchair onto a train. I knew about blue badges. I knew about the disability scheme. So a lot of the, I always say one of the big problems when you become disabled is there's no guidebook. Nobody tells you all of the things that will be really helpful for you as a disabled person in a society that frankly disables us more than anything else. Nobody gives you that guidance. And so actually having kind of grown up in amongst it, it did make that transition a lot easier. I'm not saying it was perfect and there was a lot of ugly crying involved, but I think in a way I was really privileged to have the background I did when I became disabled.
So when I'd heard that your mum is also a wheelchair user, I thought it was the same. I thought it was also Ehlers-Danlos. So it's interesting to hear it was actually very different. And also interesting that your mum had said, don't be a war correspondent because you'll end up in a wheelchair. So I get your point about the irony not being lost on you. How did you find the whole process emotionally?
I mean, I think by the time I got a diagnosis, it was just really good to have some answers. I was, I think as medical students, we all did that thing where you diagnose yourself something with something rare every, you know, couple of weeks. We all become massive hypochondriacs in medicine. And I'd actually already kind of done my research and gone, I think this might be Ehlers-Danlos syndrome. So I was actually quite smug when I was told I was right. I thought I was like house or something. So I think in a way, having the answers meant that I could make a plan. I knew what I was dealing with. I knew where the kind of limits were. I knew how bad it could get, but also I knew how mild it could be. And so that kind of just gave me a framework to work within. It was really hard. I had to deal with increasing fatigue, increasing pain, a lot of frustration about things I couldn't do anymore. But the vast majority of those things, I've just found different ways of doing them. There's very little that I absolutely cannot do. And most of the stuff I absolutely cannot do, I don't really miss too much. So I've been quite lucky in many ways. I think if I'd been, you know, an avid runner who was out every single day and sport was my life, it would have been a lot harder than it was. But actually, for me, it wasn't as bad as it could have been.
You have such an amazing positive outlook on it all, which is so nice and refreshing to hear. I think I personally would have found that really difficult, but I also, you're having your mum as a role model, that must have made such a difference to you, because you'd seen her go through it and you'd seen her have a very successful life.
Yeah, I mean, my mum was, we think, the first visibly disabled woman to read law at Cambridge. Like, I've come from a background of, you know, this is not going, nothing is going to stop you. So the day I got my diagnosis, I kind of phoned my mum, obviously, straight out of clinic. And I was like, so I've got Ehlers-Danlos syndrome. She's like, okay, right. So have you got any lectures this afternoon? And I was like, mum, I've just been told I've got a lifelong, probably quite degenerative condition. I'm now officially disabled. What the hell? And she's like, yes, and you still have a degree to finish. So what are you doing? Get back to work. And in a way, that sounds almost quite heartless, but it was exactly what I needed to hear at that point. And I think it really helped in that, you know, going into medicine when I did, I had never seen another doctor in a wheelchair. I didn't know that they even existed. And so whilst I didn't have that, and whilst I didn't have those kind of medical role models, I use role very specifically there. While I didn't have those medical role models, I had my mum who had succeeded in other fields. And so that did help a lot with the transition because, yeah, it just meant that I had somebody who wasn't going to take any nonsense from me and who still held me to account in a really important way that I think I really needed at that time.
It sounds like she was such a key part in you viewing this also positively, which is really, really nice.
Yeah, definitely. I think she's just very good at making you recognise your privilege. So, and overall, yes, my legs might not work 100%, but I'm an incredibly privileged, well-educated, middle-class white cis woman. Like, I have so much going for me, and she really made me kind of recognise that. And it was very much, okay, this is now you. What are you going to do with it? Are you going to just sit there and sulk, or are you going to try and make the lives of people like you better? And so I kind of went for the latter, because my mum told me to, and she's quite scary.
What kind of things have you done now for to help people like you? I know it's a lot.
Well, I mean, I hope if nothing else, overall, I hope that if, you know, I went under the proverbial bus tomorrow, I'd want other disabled people and more importantly, non-disabled people to look at the work I've done and go, yeah, disabled people can be in medicine. Disabled people can be in politics. And what's more, they should be. So I think making that sort of stuff achievable is really key. But I think there's then also the kind of tangible stuff. So I've done a lot of campaigning around wheelchair funding. I'm now a governor for the Mobility Foundation, which helps provide all the vehicles for disabled people that's linked to the Personal Independence Payment Scheme. We do a lot of grants and that sort of stuff, researching into how we can improve transport for disabled people. One of the things I'm quite focused on is how we can improve access to wheelchairs, because that's something I really struggle with. It's a massive postcode lottery around the UK. It's something that I took to the BMA at my second annual reps meeting, I think, and got them to pass policy saying we need to sort out wheelchair services in the NHS. I've also looked at things like cervical screening access for the 250,000 people in the UK who are hoist dependent, because at the moment, less than 1% of GP surgeries have hoists. So if you are somebody that needs a cervical screen, you are going to really struggle to access that in the big brackets normal way. So working with organisations like Joe's Cancer Trust, Joe's Cervical Cancer Trust and the Eve Appeal, who I'm an ambassador for, looking at how we increase disabled access to services like that is really big. And then there's a lot around disability and employment. So I've now done 2 TED Talks looking at disability in the NHS, disability employment, and why, frankly, employers nationally and internationally are missing a trick by not employing disabled people and not actively going out trying to employ disabled people, because I like to describe us as nature's problem solvers. We have to constantly live within a society that's designed without us in mind. I can access like a quarter of the tube network. So when you are having to solve those problems on an hour by hour basis through your life, you become really blooming good at it. So yeah, I now do a lot of kind of talking to national and now international companies about how they can improve their recruitment policies for disabled people, and looking at the disability employment gap and that sort of stuff to try and make that a bit better too.
Gosh, you're such an inspiration. Wow. And to think that you became disabled, is that the right way? Is that the right way to say it?
Yeah,
you became a disabled person.
Yeah.
I don't want to say the wrong thing. Think you became a disabled person and you've still done, you've taken it and you've done so much to pay it forward and to help other people. And that's just amazing. And also you're talking about things that I've never even thought of, like cervical cancer screening. I've never even thought about how would a disabled person access this. And it's still so important. We talk about how important screening is, and yet we aren't even thinking about how to make it inclusive for everyone. So thank you for even raising that to me. It's the sort of thing I would never have even crossed my mind. And I'm so glad there are people out there like yourself advocating for your team, for your people.
Well, yeah, I think that's exactly why it's so important that we have disabled voices in the conversation, because I didn't think about this stuff until I became disabled. Like, why would I? Yeah. And I think there's so much kind of guilt out there, and people are so scared of doing the wrong thing, saying the wrong thing. But intrinsically, people are good, right? They want everyone to have equal access to stuff. But you don't know what the problems are unless you ask the community, or unless you platform the people who can tell you what they are. So I think that's really important, is to kind of go, right, no guilt. I don't know about this. Who can I ask? Or at least, can I platform people who will raise these issues? And as long as we're all doing that in our various ways.
Who can I pass the mic to?
Exactly. Passing the mic is something the Women's Equality Party are obsessed with. We have a whole pass the mic series. So yes, pass the mic.
How did you find your life changed clinically? I know you were a medical student. How did you find things changed when you started using a wheelchair? Because that is a huge life change.
Yeah. And let's be honest, clinical careers are not really set up for wheelchair users. It was really challenging. And I think the main difficulty I had was that nobody knew how to make it work. I just had to work it out as I went. And I was incredibly lucky. Shouldn't be a matter of luck, but I was incredibly lucky in that I was very well supported by my med school, by the clinicians around me, who were just kind of like, okay, well, this is a first. We're going to see how we can do this. So things like, from really basic stuff, like I can't push the computers on wheels because I'm pushing myself. And so it ends up with like one arm on the computer on wheels, one arm on my wheel, and I just go around in circles. So, you know, quite early on, I'm like, right, I'm going to need my own laptop that I can just put on my lap. And by the end of my F1 year, everyone was really jealous that I had my own laptop. Like all the other F1s, it's like, why don't we want one of those? So that was a wonky perk. Things like, you know, carrying folders, all of that sort of stuff. Like, I can mobilize without a wheelchair. I have stairs in my house. I'm, you know, quite a mobile wheelchair user in many ways, but actually 80% of wheelchair users are. Most of us can get out of our chair and wiggle around a bit. But the chair enables me to work the hours I work without too much pain, without too much fatigue. Sometimes I'll go into work on a stick. The other day I forgot my stick and I was literally bouncing off the walls of my surgery. And my boss was like, please, can you just get your chair out the car, because you are going to fall over and I'm going to have to pick you up. But, you know, there are various things I can do, but it gives me that flexibility to kind of say, you know what, if I didn't have this chair, I'd be stuck in bed today. But I have this chair, so I can go and be a doctor. I can go out and see my friends. And I know that I'm not going to be in massive pain or wiped out for days as a result. And I think that's something that I really hadn't realized before I got a chair, and a lot of clinicians don't realize, is how much an improvement on your quality of life it can be. And so I get a lot of people who kind of expect a doctor to magically tell them they need a wheelchair. And nobody's ever told doctors to tell people this. We don't necessarily feel trained to do that.
No.
And so my point to patients is kind of like, look, if you think a walking stick would help you, use a walking stick. If you think a wheelchair will improve your quality of life and what you're able to do, use a wheelchair. You only get one life. Don't sit in your house waiting to be bad enough to use it. There's not going to be some kind of magical moment where you're sort of like, yeah, I'm wonky enough, I can now justify this. That doesn't happen.
That is our problem as humans. We like wait till we're too bad to then be told we need help, rather than actually proactively being like, let's try and help myself now.
Exactly. And that's one of the things I talk about a lot with kind of NHS employers in particular, around reasonable adjustments for disabled people. It's not about giving someone the equipment to do the job. It's about empowering them to do the best job they can. And that's really key, because, you know, we have so much to offer as disabled employees, but so often our potential is wasted because the NHS does the bare minimum to support. And, you know, we did a massive disability staff survey in the BMA a couple of years ago, which shows that, like, I think 55% of doctors with disabilities got the reasonable adjustments they needed.
Oh, my gosh.
And these are adjustments they're legally entitled to under the Equality Act 2010. But only 55% of doctors were getting them. So we have a big problem with not supporting people to do their very best in the workplace. And as such, we are missing out on so much talent and so much ability.
Yeah.
Because we're basically disabling people by not supporting them.
And it's like, it's just really devaluing people in a wheelchair, because it's saying, well, just because your legs don't work, we're acting as if you don't work. But that's not the case. We need to support wheelchair users or disabled people and doctors to be able to reach their potential rather than ignore them.
And to kind of acknowledge that we bring something really unique to the health service. Like, patients relate to me in a completely different way because I have clearly seen a doctor or two in my time. That whole kind of like paternalistic divide we often have in medicine,
yeah,
is really, really narrowed when you are a visibly disabled person, because the patient can relate to you and because they know you have this intrinsic understanding of what they're going through. And so we bring a huge amount to the health service, and we need to be seen not as, you know, a cohort that needs to be adjusted for and supported because it's the right thing to do, but actually we should be adjusting and supporting and actively recruiting because they make us better as a service. And that's kind of, I think, the brain switch that the whole NHS has to have, is just going, right, diversity makes us better, so how do we do that? And that's what we're not very good at the moment.
Gosh, this is so interesting. And it's like not the sort of thing I've thought about. And I'll admit, because as an able-bodied person, I don't come across disability that much. I've seen, I follow a few disabled doctors on Instagram. I see a few disabled doctors at work sometimes. But these sorts of conversations and thoughts don't cross my mind because they don't need to, in a way, which is really selfish and really like, I'm just like acknowledging my privilege here. But these things don't cross my mind, and they're so important.
They are. And I think that's the thing. Like, it's not going to cross your mind. It should be completely normal that we're surrounded by colleagues from all backgrounds, all physical abilities. You know, that should just be so normalized that we don't have to think about it. The main thing is that as long as we're platforming that diversity, you shouldn't have to. And like, it'd be like me trying to speak for colleagues who are from ethnic minorities. It would be completely inappropriate. For me to sit there and say, right, this colleague needs X, this colleague needs X, this is what we should do to support this community, because I'm not from there. But I will sit there and go, okay, I'm not the person to talk about this. Have you spoken to Renegade? Have you spoken to, you know, my other colleagues who do get this? So I think those are the kind of conversations we need to be having and celebrating the massive diversity that is and should be in the NHS.
Yeah, it's so true. And I do what I can to talk about being an Asian woman in medicine. It's sad because sometimes you feel like the burden shouldn't be on the people who are marginalized. And that is often a common theme that people say. But I find it hard. I don't want anyone else to talk about my problems. And I'm sure you wouldn't want me to talk about what it's like to be a disabled doctor as a non-disabled doctor. So I have to let other people speak and pass the mic, as we were saying, because how can I talk about your lived experience? I can't do it justice.
I think there's a big difference between kind of taking over, like centering yourself and speaking for other groups. And I think, you know, we need to get to that point where our automatic reaction, and this is, you know, one of the reasons we have so many panels at NHS conferences where the entire panel is made of men, is because not one single person has gone, have you got any women on this panel? And if not, here are a whole selection of people you should ask before you ask me. And that's allyship. And that's kind of taking yourself off the center and just going, look, actually this is how I'm supporting. It's not about expecting other people to educate you, but it's about giving them a platform. Those are two different things.
You had mentioned that you've had some nice experiences with patients who kind of feel that you get them more because you've obviously seen a doctor or two. Can you share some of those experiences with us? I think that would be really nice to hear.
Yeah, I mean, like, one of the things I find really interesting is that a lot of patients, particularly where I am, I'm in a really great area of Leeds, and they call a spade up here. And so they will walk in and go, bloody hell, what happened to you? And you're like, hi, nice to meet you. I'm Dr. Hannah Tacey. But actually what they're doing there is they're trying to, as I say, kind of like narrow that paternalistic gap, and kind of get on a par. And also there's a lot of anxiety that I think as clinicians we forget how anxious people get before seeing doctors. I get terrified before seeing my doctor.
Me too.
Right? But we forget about that side of things. And so when people walk in and go, what did you do to yourself? They're not being assholes. They're just trying to mitigate that and to rebalance it, whether or not they realize that's what they're doing most of the time. But like, I've had patients who we've really struggled. Like, one in my very first job was elderly care, which I didn't get on with particularly. But yeah, it was an elderly care job. And we'd got this patient who really didn't want to talk to anyone and was like being quite kind of not obstructive, but just didn't want to engage, didn't want to do like discharge planning, all this sort of stuff. And they kind of sent me in to have a chat. And at the end of the conversation, she'd like completely opened up. And I was like, okay, I'm clearly some kind of communications genius right now because she's actually talking. And then she said at the end of the conversation, "See, I know you get it, doc, because you're broken like I am." And I mean, I ugly cried quite hard having rolled out that room. I'm just like, oh,
wow.
But I think that really encapsulated for me the bridging of that divide between patient and doctor. And, you know, I get kids, like actually when I was at George's, I did a job in ENT. And every time I had to go down to A&E, it was like opposite ends of the hospital, very long corridor. I was like, I would come down in the lift and there'd often be a kid in a wheelchair in the lift with me, or I'd bump into one in the corridor. We have little races. We like compared wheelchairs. And parents would often go, oh my goodness, look, there's a doctor and she's in a wheelchair. And you could just see these kids kind of light up going, oh my goodness, I could do that. That could be me. And that kind of moment of recognition, because often they've never seen a professional of any kind in a wheelchair before. Seeing that face to face, I mean, to them it's like meeting Harry Potter. I'm not saying I'm Harry Potter, but like it's a really big moment of kind of realization. Yeah, for them.
So powerful.
Yeah, and also I got to have races. I'm not sure I was meant to have races down the corridors, but I did. So I think it did make a big difference, and it really helped me see that it was worth fighting to stay in medicine because it was having a positive impact on my patients, my being there.
Did you ever consider that being in a wheelchair would stop you being a doctor?
Yeah. Sometimes I still do. I mean, now in GP, it's not so bad. Like, I can do most things. But physically, I found, you know, on calls, that sort of stuff really difficult. I loved my A&E rotation. I did it at George's. I absolutely adored every minute. But the rota broke me. I could not physically cope much beyond the 4 months I had to do, and I was quite ill by the time I finished. And so, you know, I think if I wasn't as disabled as I am, I probably would have stayed in A&E because I loved it. And I also have ADHD, and actually there does seem to be quite a big correlation between ADHD and emergency medicine. I think it's the new shiny, exciting things going off every 10 minutes with massive dopamine. But yeah, so I think there have been points, particularly when I first became disabled, where I was just kind of like, nobody's ever done this. Have they ever done this? I don't know. But I kind of decided that I was just going to take it a day at a time and see what happened. And if something went completely wrong, then yeah, I'd have to have a rethink. And I guess I've always been cognizant of the fact that, you know, tomorrow I could dislocate something catastrophically and my career could be over. And that's just something I've kind of had to come to live with. But then, you know, tomorrow I could go under a bus. Like, anything could happen. And I refuse to spend my life waiting for something that may never happen. So I have backup plans. I have a portfolio career. I'm really blessed in everything else I get to do. If I can't practice medicine, I'd be devastated, but I'd manage. And I'm not going to spend the rest of my life worrying about the big what ifs, because there's no point. That's no way to live your life.
That's so true. That's something that someone taught me when I was in F1. I think I spent not comparable, but I guess you can compare it a bit. But I didn't know if I wanted to do pediatric training because I was like, well, what if when I want children I can't do this, and what if it's like this, and what if it's like that? Mm-hmm. And my registrar was like, Radhika, you can't live your life thinking about, you can't plan for a what if future. You just got to do what you enjoy now. And that really like changed something in me. I spent so long trying to plan for all these different potential future outcomes when really I just should have and ended up doing what I enjoyed now, there and then. Yeah. And you can change. And that's the beauty. One of the beauties of medicine is how much flexibility and adjustment there is in there. And then, as you say, you're now doing a portfolio career. So you can, if you need to, you can do more of that and less of clinical medicine to balance what you're able to do physically.
Exactly. And I've already kind of done that to an extent in that I started my GP training at 80%. I started F1 at 100%. I did my first 2 years at 100%, which was insane.
How did you do that?
I have no, I mean, in fairness, F2, I was seconded 20% to the BMA. So that did help a lot. So I was working 100%, but clinically only 80, which was really good. But then, you know, I started GP training at 80 and now I'm 60. And that works really well for me, because actually from a mental and physical perspective, I don't want to be doing any more than 60. And I burnt out epically during the pandemic. And I realized that my mental health, like putting the physical side to one side, my mental health is so much better not working full time, that I'm just not going to. And having a portfolio career, and GP is a particular specialty that allows you to do that. So yeah, I consider myself very lucky to be doing what I'm doing for as long as I can.
That's amazing. Like I said, I can't believe that you did F1 at 100%, because, and like you were saying about an A&E rotation, I found my A&E rotation exhausting. And to be doing it in a wheelchair, I can't even imagine how hard that must be, because you're physically having to work a lot. And then also that's the mental strain of being an A&E SHO, which is so hard. And the rota, as you say, oh my gosh, A&E rota is not something I would like to go back to ever again.
It was so brutal. But nobody told me I could work less than full time. Nobody had ever sat down and gone, Hannah, you don't have to work 100%. So I just did, because I thought that was what I had to do. So I think there's so much work that we can do in the organization of just kind of like empowering people to know what their options are.
Yeah.
And then letting them make the decision. Because I think throughout training, whatever specialty you go into, we're often so infantilized by the system. And actually having that knowledge of how things work, of what your contractual rights are, she said, going all trade unionist on your ass. Like, you know, knowing this stuff is power. Knowing that you can accept your report, knowing what your rota is meant to look like, knowing when you're meant to get it, knowing how much you're meant to work, all of these things make training bearable, in my mind. And yeah, it should just be the norm that people know what their rights are from before they qualify.
And also allow you to advocate for yourself, which you should do as a doctor. Like, you're not a child. You should be able to advocate for yourself, and you should be able to like be paid correctly, have the correct leave, and do things as your contract says, and as an adult should be allowed to do.
Yeah, it drives me absolutely mad. There are points where I have to just kind of turn around to some of my senior colleagues and go, I'm 34 years old. I have a mortgage. I have a cat. I have a partner. Like, I don't want to do this, and I don't have to do this, and I can walk away at any point, or in my case, roll away at any point. And so, yeah, like an adult, or I'll go elsewhere. And we don't have enough doctors for all of us to do that.
You'd mentioned your work with the Women's Equality Party. Can you tell us a bit more about that? Because I think that's really interesting and also very topical for the podcast.
Yes. So it's one of the best things I do. I absolutely love this party. So, as I said, I'd kind of sworn off party politics. I'd done a bit of campaigning for the Lib Dems before Nick Clegg got in, and then kind of completely backpedaled on tuition fees. And then I'd kind of been vaguely looked at Labour Party and gone, yeah, I mean, like, ethically, I'm kind of on board. But I just felt like voices of people like me, of women in particular, were just never really being heard. And that there was so much infighting. I was just exhausted by all the infighting. Ironically, I was exhausted by the politics. So yeah, I'd never expected to go into party politics at all. I was enjoying my trade unionism very much. Thank you very much. But I kind of went on that conference the first day, and by the end of it, I was just surrounded by people of all genders and none who really wanted to see things improve, and who believed that equality for everyone is progress for everyone. If we sort out some of the massive inequalities in society, like childcare, like violence against women and girls, like education, if we sort out all of these inequalities, it benefits the whole of society. Because, you know, if we sort out the gender pay gap, then frankly, the men who on the whole live with these women who are being paid less than they should financially benefit, because more money is coming into the household. If we sort out childcare, then that is better for dads as well. Like, men have shared parental leave now as an option because majoritarily women campaign for it. So I think, you know, there's so many ways in which if we can promote this equality agenda throughout every single element. And fundamentally, I do believe that the patriarchy does kind of imbue itself into every element of our society. But if we can push back and we can say, here is the whole of society, here is how we're going to make every single part of that more equal. If we can improve women's representation in society, at the moment only 34% of our MPs are female. That's ridiculous. Like, that makes absolutely no sense in 2022. Like, our cabinet is not gender balanced. Our parliament is not gender balanced. It's even worse at local council level. Like, we've got so much work to do. And if you look at things like our response to COVID, if you compare our response to COVID to Finland, right? I'm not picking that out of the blue. I am just a bit obsessed with Finland. Finland has proportional representation as a voting system. Firstly, definitely need it. Our current voting system is absolute twaddle. But they have a government that's made up of five parties. Each of those party leaders happens to be female. They have the most gender balanced parliament in Europe.
Wow.
And you know which country had the best COVID outcomes, both from an economic and a health perspective? It was Finland. Because trust in their government, and we have all the data to show it, trust in the Finnish government was higher than it was in any other government in Europe. And that's because women were around the table too. It was representative. They considered things like childcare in their COVID response. If you look at our COVID responses, if you look at, you know, those bloody awful inaccessible briefings that we had every freaking night, where lots of men would stand behind podiums and go rah, 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 and never had a sign language interpreter.
Next slide.
But, you know, our response was crap. We never had any men doing those briefings, really. And when they did, if they said anything against the government, the regime, the government, then they were swiftly got rid of. That's what happened to the chief nurse. So I think, you know, when you have equality, you have better health outcomes, you have better economic outcomes, you have better educational outcomes. And so when it comes to the Women's Equality Party, like, my role is making change happen. So I kind of run our campaigns and elections. Let's be frank, we are not going to roll into number 10 tomorrow. Okay, I am not envisaging us setting up a government in the next 5 years. But the way we work is that we contest elections to make other parties raise their game on the issues that we think matter. So, for example, in November, I ran for the Police, Fire and Crime Commissioner of North Yorkshire. And that election, there was a by-election. It came about because the previous incumbent had made some awful comments. Shockingly, white cis man had made some awful comments about the murder of Sarah Everard. We protested. I turned up to meetings with him and the panel that were meant to be overlooking him with lists of questions and grilled him. And he resigned 3 hours later. So he resigned and we said, right, OK, we're going to contest this by-election, not because I thought I was going to win. Though if I had won, I'd have been in charge of all the fire engines in North Yorkshire, which sounded so cool. I contested that election because I wanted every single hustings to be about what each candidate was going to do to end violence against women and girls, what each candidate was going to do to hold the police to account in tackling these crimes, what each candidate was going to do to address the fact that we have a 1.4% conviction rate for rape in this country. Like, I wanted them all to have to talk about this stuff. And that's the stuff politicians hate talking about because it's hard and because it doesn't win votes. But every single hustings, they had to come with their manifesto. And if it wasn't good enough, I called it out. And I said, this isn't going to work. This isn't going to work. Here are all our policies. Take them. Take them. I honestly do not care. If I do not get elected, I want you to use all of these policies to make the lives of women and girls safer. And it worked because every single hustings, they had to do that. And so I think, you know, that's the way that we work, is we turn up and we make life difficult for the other parties until they up their game on equality. And the second we have equality, we're done. I'm going to go and find myself a beach somewhere. It'll take a wee while, so we'll keep fighting.
That's amazing. I love that. So you're basically there to ruffle feathers and to make people listen and to make change. That is really amazing to hear. Thank you so much for sharing that. And how have you found that interacts with your clinical work? Or does it not really?
So on the whole, obviously a lot of what I talk about with the Women's Equality Party is women's health. And so having that kind of medical background is really useful because I can sit there and go, you know, we need to talk about Black women's maternal mortality rates. We need to be talking about all of these other areas. most of the time I try and keep the two relatively separate if I can.
Yeah.
Occasionally my patients Google me, which is hilarious. And on the whole, they're absolutely fab about it. I had one recently who was like, so I don't know whether I should tell you that I Googled you. You get yourself into some weird situations, don't you, doc? It's like, yeah, I do. But I love it. Is that a problem? No, good. Come on. So I think it actually really benefits my clinical practice in many ways, because I'm so much more aware of the many challenges that women face in our society. And, you know, if you want to know why women present so much more with anxiety and depression, part of that is probably going to be because we don't feel safe going out at night. And we've been told that we're not safe from the day we were born. And we have a society where we feel under threat at all times. That's going to make you freaking anxious, isn't it? And we can't like deny that healthcare is political. Look at the current abortion situation in the US. Like Roe versus Wade is going to come down probably tomorrow. We're now recording this on the 23rd of June. You know, Roe versus Wade is going to come down tomorrow. That's going to take away tens of millions of women's rights to reproductive health. That is intrinsically a political issue, but it's about healthcare. And I think we deny the link between the two at our peril. As clinicians, we're always told we have to be like completely impartial and all that sort of stuff. Sod it. No, I'm not going to be impartial. When my patients are suffering and in some cases dying, I'm not going to be freaking impartial about it.
I wondered, would you be open to talking a bit more about your brother, Gareth, and the work you've now done since he passed away with organ donation?
Yeah, gosh, it's been a wee while. So before Gareth died, when I was doing my nursing degree, he'd already had a transplant when he was 14 and I was 16. When I started my nursing degree, I was approached by an organisation that was then called Live Life, Then Give Life, is now Live Life, Give Life, and approached to become a trustee of the charity. And it was a charity that basically promoted organ donation, but tried to do it in a really kind of family friendly, open way. And this was before we had an opt-out system. So many, many people were dying, not getting the organs they needed, because to be a donor, you basically had to have a donor card. So, you know, there was a massive shortage of organs. There still is, but it was even worse. And so I got quite involved in that for a couple of years before my nursing degree. I actually apparently had to study for finals, which was outrageous. So I did quite a bit of work around that. And when Gareth died, I kind of picked a little bit of that up again and did some, you know, events for the British Heart Foundation and that sort of thing. I think there's a lot of fear around organ donation. There's a lot of misunderstanding. And particularly, there are issues with, you know, minority groups that those people really struggle to get transplants. You are still more likely to need a transplant than you are to become an organ donor. And actually, it's conversation that I feel like we're having less and less now we've got an opt-out system. But I think it should be more in the press and the media than it is, because it changes lives. Like Gareth got another 9 years. I got another 9 years with my brother that I wouldn't have had otherwise. And he got to, you know, go and do a degree and do all of this sort of stuff, which otherwise he wouldn't have had. And so I think it's really important that we have these conversations about it. And actually one of the coolest things Live Life, Give Life did was, sadly after my tenure, Ed Sheeran's first ever music video. No, it wasn't Ed Sheeran. It was, oh God, I've just gone completely blank. Scottish guy.
Lewis Capaldi,
thank you. Well done. Lewis Capaldi's first music video was dedicated to Live Life, Then Give Life. It was done in partnership with them, starring Peter Capaldi, which is also super cool. And so, yeah, you know, it's just about kind of having those conversations, because in that music video, Peter Capaldi has lost his wife when she hasn't got an organ transplant in time or something like that. And it's just about having those conversations and normalising it. So when I do get to talk about this, which is actually very rare now, so thank you. I think it's just about like saying what a massive difference it can make. Just being on the waiting list is terrifying, and it's horrific to see the person you love slowly wasting away, clinging on to a mobile phone, hoping that it's going to ring in time. it was the hardest thing my family's ever been through. And so to kind of have that gift, and it is a gift, and it means a lot to me that people ideally choose to make the decision to be a donor, to have that is, yeah, it's an incredible thing you can do for another human being. I think it's probably the best thing you can do for another human being is to plan for what you want in the event of your death that can save multiple lives.
And after your death, you can still change and make such a difference to so many lives,
yeah,
by being an organ donor. It really is amazing. Thank you for sharing that story. So I heard you talking about it on your TEDx talk, mm-hmm. And that's why I wanted to talk about it a bit more, because I know you, and as we've seen in this conversation, or as we've heard in this conversation, there's so much more to you than just being a disabled person. And I don't want to make this conversation just about what it's like to be a disabled doctor or a disabled person. And that's why I wanted to just talk a bit more about the other things you do as well. And you have so much to your story. And I think talking about Gareth and talking about being an organ donor was also really important, and that's why I wanted to touch on it with you.
No, I'm really glad you did. Thank you, because it's not something I get to talk about very much, because most of the time people want me to talk about disability, so it's really refreshing. Thank you.
That's all right. You've done so much in your career, and I wanted to ask, what would you say you are most proud of, or what is your biggest achievement when you look back on all the things you've done or that you do at the moment?
So, I mean, I'm really lucky in that I consider myself just to be a very gobby person who spends too much time on Twitter, really. And I think I gained a bit of notoriety for doing that. But actually, I think the things I'm most proud of, the moments I'm most proud are when disabled young people or LGBTQ young people reach out to me and say, "You're doing this, how can I?" Because I want to get to a stage where every single young person can look at themselves and know, if I want to be a doctor, I can do that. If I want to be a politician, I can do that. If I want to go and do whatever else crazy crap Hannah gets up to, I can do that. And so I think those moments when people see me as somebody they can ask for help from and ask for support from, those are the proudest moments, because, you know, I can reply and go, you know, here's what I've experienced, here's what I think, here are some, you know, resources you might want to look at, whatever it might be. Often I have no idea where they've gone from there, but that potential is just awesome. And it's a really tricky balance putting yourself out there. Like, I get a lot of slack for what I do. You know, you can't have that many Twitter followers and not get a fair bit of abuse. And a lot of people kind of sit there and go, "Oh, look, you're doing your disability talk again," or whatever it might be. But actually, by doing that, by being visible and making the next generation's lives easier, so I'm going to keep doing it. And that's, you know, however many incels want to DM me abuse, fine, they can crack on, because it does make a difference and it does help the next lot coming through. So, yeah, those are probably the proudest things. I mean, the rest of it's great fun and I'm very lucky, and I think a lot of the opportunities I've had, I've actually been afforded in a way because of my disability. And so I can never really resent being disabled, ever. And I'm really lucky with the opportunities I've had and the privilege I have. But the things that make me most proud are, yeah, seeing what the next generation's getting up to because they've noticed some other wonky birds having a go and they think they can probably do it too. That's great.
That must be so... like, just feel that must feel so nice that you are inspiring another generation of people, and especially people who now feel seen seeing you and feel that they can actually make it. And yeah, as you say, do what Hannah's doing or do what another doctor in a wheelchair is doing. That kind of makes it feel worth it.
Yeah, I want them to not only do what I'm doing, I want them to do it better, and they probably will. And that would be absolutely fab. I want them all to come along and, yeah, change the world in ways I haven't been able to, because that's how we make progress, isn't it? It's by raising up the next generation, by passing the mic.
Yeah. And what would you say, if you could give a younger Hannah a piece of advice, what would that be? It doesn't need to be in a specific point of time.
So it's really interesting. I did a talk this morning for Pride Month about being disabled and queer for the Black Country NHS Healthcare Trust. And I was asked this exact question. So it's been on my mind. Yeah. So, you know, you clearly hit a theme today. I think what I would tell younger Hannah is to take your time, firstly, because my gut response to everything is to rage at stuff, all guns blazing, and fix it. But take your time. Find your tribe. Like, I would not be here if it wasn't for some amazing disabled and queer people who have gone before me, who have supported me, who have reached out at the hardest times. Finding those people is the most important thing, I think. But also learning which battles to fight and which to kind of take a step back on and try platforming other people and supporting other people to take those battles on. Because, yeah, as a quite gobby, quite independent person, that's not my natural response. And that's taken a lot of learning. But I think kind of highlighting those three things would be what I think younger Hannah could have done with learning a bit sooner.
But we need to make our mistakes to learn from them. You need to have made whatever mistakes you did to become the Hannah you are today. Yeah,
definitely. I don't really regret anything. I refuse to regret things in my life because, you know, I can't 100% say I wouldn't do them again. But I think we just keep learning. And I do so much kind of EDI stuff at the moment. I'm constantly going to organisations and talking about diversity widely. And it's not meant to be there's not meant to be a final destination. There is not a point where you become you and you're done, where you learn everything you need to, where you always get it right.
You've completed life.
And frankly,
life.
If you get to that point, that sounds really freaking boring, doesn't it? Like, I don't want to live like that. No. So yeah, I think we need to just acknowledge life as a journey and see where you end up, really.
And what's next for you? Have you got anything major planned in the coming few months?
Coming few months? Oh, good question. I mean, I have ADHD. I'm impressed if I can remember what I'm doing tomorrow. So I've got kind of more talks. I'm going off to Amsterdam to give a talk later on, which is in September, which is great. I'm doing a conference in Malaysia, which should be fun.
Are you going there?
No, it's virtual. I'm so annoyed. I said, yeah, I'll come to Malaysia. But, you know, hopefully doing a bit more media stuff. I'm in talks about doing some more media work. And at some point, there is a book.
Ooh.
That has been started. But then I keep finding other projects. So I actually hadn't told anyone apart from my coach that I started the book. So there you go. You've just got an exclusive. I haven't even told my partner I've started the book yet. So I'm going to have an awkward conversation.
Well, thank you for sharing that piece of information. Don't worry, you've got a few weeks until this is out for you to tell your partner. Wow, Hannah, well, thank you so much for this conversation. I have learned so much just from this 1 hour talking to you. You've really opened my eyes to a lot of different aspects of life, of being a doctor, of being a disabled person, and of being a woman that I haven't thought about before. So really big thanks to you for that. And I've really loved meeting you. So thank you, Hannah. I will leave links to everything, to your website, to your Twitter, to your TEDx talks. I really love listening to them, in the show notes as well.
That's great. Well, thank you so much for having me. I'm loving this show idea. So this is fab. You've got yourself a new subscriber.
Oh, thank you so much. Thanks so much for listening. If you've enjoyed the show so far, then don't forget to subscribe and please leave a review on your podcast app, as it really helps other people find out about it. If you have any feedback or suggestions, drop me a line on my Instagram @DrRadica. The link is in the show notes. Have a good week.